Welcome to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Beau Willimon's play, The Parisian Woman, is set not in Paris, but in present-day Washington, D.C., where powerful friends are the only kind worth having. It stars Uma Thurman as the wife of a tax lawyer who uses every weapon in her arsenal to further her husband's political ambitions. It's playing in a limited engagement at the newly renovated Hudson Theater on West 44th Street. And I am very pleased to welcome, right here across from me, Uma Thurman. Thank you very much for being here.
Good to see you, Jonathan. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, so you've been in dozens of films, including Oscar nomination for Pulp Fiction, the two Kill Bill movies, Dangerous Liaisons, but this is your Broadway debut.
Yes, it is.
But is this your, this is not your first theatrical role, right?
Well, the only professional theatrical role that I did was in The Misanthrope in the Classic Stage Theater a long time ago, when my first child was less than one.
Hmm.
So it's been a long gap.
Uh-huh. So then why did you decide to take on this challenge now?
Well, I had been wanting to go to the stage, get back on the stage for all of these years. I'm not exactly sure how it happened that I didn't, but I was in the process of searching for the right piece to do, and I was introduced to Pamela McKinnon, and she and I connected, and I was just basically meeting her generally to talk about, you know, the transfer of, you know, the transfer of sort of the disciplines of screen acting to the stage, and, you know, getting her advice and thoughts on things. And at the end of the meeting, she said, "I have something for you to read."
Hmm. And we should say that the woman you're talking about, Pam McKinnon, she's the director.
She is the director, yes. So she had been working with Beau on this piece for some time. And that was several years ago before the election. So when I first read the play, it was a very, very different piece. Similar mm-hmm. in structure, characters, and twist, but a very different piece entirely.
Right, because when you see it now, it is thoroughly in present-day Washington, D.C. But when you read the piece, was Trump a factor in it? Was it, or just all very general about some mythic president and these mythic White House staffers?
It was a mythic president. It had the sort of, you know, the irony and the sort of hard-bitten cynicism of any point of view on Washington, but it didn't quite have the snap that it has now.
I love the way you put that. Well, you know, Beau is, and correct me if I'm wrong, the creator of House of Cards.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're watching this show, you can't get away from the fact that there's a very House of Cards element. Do you think that since this was written, as you said, before the election, that Beau felt like he had no choice but to make it as present day and real as possible?
Well, I was participant in that because we'd already done a reading of the play in its previous incarnation, and knew each other, you know, during the process of the election. And, you know, it could have gone either way. Like, either the play would have become irrelevant due to the changes in the world, or it had to move itself into this, you know, this kind of phenomena that we are, phenomenon, whatever, that we are witnessing right now in Washington. So it chose to move towards the amazing.
Now, before you, before the election and everything, you read this role. What was it about Chloe? That's your character's
yes.
name. What was it about Chloe that appealed to you, that made you say, I want to do this role?
Well, actually, for, you know, even in my film work, which is very varied all over the place, one of my favorite passions is new writing. You know, believe it or not, when I met Quentin Tarantino, he'd made one film, and, you know, he was a new writer. Pulp Fiction was new writing, and for example, and, you know, or Gattaca is another film I made with Andrew Niccol, which is set in the future. But, you know, I had said to myself as I contemplated going to the stage that the right thing, the ideal situation, should I find it, would be to find a character that was not hadn't been defined 800 times by 800 probably more skilled actresses than myself, but to find a piece of new writing and an interesting character. And in the case of the character of Chloe, she just jammed out at me as this incredibly modern woman, very liberated, very self-assured, and very powerful personality. And I felt that this was exactly the T-section. You know, combine that with Pamela McKinnon, a great director, a female director. To me, I felt like if I had asked God for, you know, a prescription, I was sent the exact medicine that I asked for. So
Chloe, is she a woman who knows who she is and what she wants, and by God, she's going to go after it and get it?
I think that she is a combination. I think part of the play is also about people in this modern moment feeling a call to action of some kind. You know, people who have lived out their lives privately, for survival or acquiring wealth, or, you know, these are very upper middle class characters, feeling that the shift in society that's taking place is actually called upon them to define themselves as citizens. And I think that's part of the narrative that is taking place in this play. So I think she's, you know, as she says in the play, I know some people think I'm a dilettante. And in a way, she has been living mm-hmm. her life as a sort of dabbler, an explorer of life, choosing sensuality and passion for art over mission. And I think in this narrative, this character sort of finds herself in modern day Washington and discovers some sort of moral imperative.
Right. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Uma Thurman, who stars in The Parisian Woman, which is at the Hudson Theater on 44th Street. So Chloe is complicated.
Very.
She does.
So am I, so it's okay.
And she does some not very nice things, but you find yourself rooting for her as the story wends its way from the beginning to end. Is that a delicate balancing act for you?
Oh, it was from that point of view in the rehearsal process and so on, like, you know, it's a very complicated character to get across with authenticity and to, you know, not pull all of the punches. She's sort of a master manipulator who finds herself with a cause. But, you know, you take that same character and give them a bad motivation and it's not quite so pretty.
Right. All right. So we have to talk about Chloe's husband, Tom.
Yes.
Played by Josh Lucas. Mm-hmm. He's a tax lawyer. He's up for an important judgeship. And this is the best part. I mean, she hopes that her lover, Peter, who's played by Martin Sokas, will be able to help him secure the nomination. Now, I have a tendency to give stuff away, but since this is in the beginning of the play, how do the two men know each other?
Really through her. it is also, you know, a really interesting play, and I think surprising to a lot of people because it sort of expresses a marriage with very open parameters. And that's something that I don't think a lot of people witness. You know, there's, you know, mischief taking place, but it's not deceit between husband and wife. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the conceits of the play.
Right. And that's what's funny, because the play opens with you in your very well-appointed living room.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter is there, and he is... he's like wildly jealous, and he's wild, like, who are you texting? Who are you on the phone with? Who is that? And then someone comes in and he says, who is that? And you say, it's my husband.
You're giving it all away.
Oh, but it's in the beginning. It's in the beginning. And I've
know,
already said
people
that.
Really,
you know,
enjoy it.
No, but it's hilarious. It is a great moment. And so I was riffing on the fact that you said that there are open parameters in the marriage, but there's no deceit between husband and wife, and yet in the opening scene we see Chloe completely, totally deceiving Peter.
Absolutely. And that comes from the original play, La Parisienne. My accent is bad, but the original play was sort of outstanding in its time because it took the normal sort of bedroom comedy drama of, you know, the cuckolded husband and flipped it around where, in fact, the lover was being cuckolded in a way, in a very complicated way, where the husband and wife were actually aligned, although not necessarily faithful.
Mm-hmm. So there's a third character involved, and that is Jeanette, played by Blair Brown. Very convincingly, the thing that I loved about this play as someone who lives in Washington and has lived in Washington for 10 years was how completely believable this play is about what Washington is and how things happen. And Jeanette is like the quintessential Washington figure. Talk about her.
Well, Jeanette is a friend of Chloe and is sort of someone that Chloe is a power broker that Chloe is cultivating a closeness with. It's kind of unclear exactly why in the beginning, but you know that's one of Chloe's sort of roles in her husband's life is to sort of to be the, you know, the connective tissue between him and powerful people in society. And Jeanette is someone that Chloe has carefully cultivated a relationship with to hopefully offer assistance
to her husband.
Yes.
And the judgeship. There's a great scene where Jeanette and Chloe are on the balcony and they're talking. And there's this whole sort of rhetorical dance that's happening mm-hmm. between Jeanette and Chloe, with Chloe doing a lot of dancing to mm-hmm. try to coax Jeanette.
It's very seductive. You know, yes, she's trying to coax her into, she's seducing her, basically, mm-hmm. In essence.
And then we have Jeanette's daughter.
Right.
Rebecca, who comes into this scene. And in a lot of ways, she is a lot like Chloe, but completely different from Chloe.
Well, I mean, I think what they share is that, I mean, Chloe is a person who's chosen not to have a mission in life per se, but she sort of is an idealist on a lot of levels. And there's something about her that's almost maybe even a purist. And this young woman is, you know, a young, passionate Democrat aspiring to dedicate her life to service.
And she's very young. Her mother brags on her that she went to Harvard and then she's going to run. Her life was
completely for undergrad.
Yes, completely plotted out her life, and she was going to be president.
Exactly.
At one point, Rebecca says she wouldn't be that. She didn't think she'd be the first, but maybe the third or something like that.
Well, actually, that's a very interesting line, because you know, I hope I'm not the first or the second, maybe the third. Obviously, any young idealist would hope that they wouldn't be the first, because that means we're going to wait another 20 years before mm-hmm. we see a female in the White House.
I want to get more into the play. We got to take a little break.
All righty.
The voice you just heard is Uma Thurman. She is making her Broadway debut in the play The Parisian Woman. Later on in the show, Leah Salonga, who is starring in the Broadway revival of Once on This Island with Lynn Ahrens, who wrote the book and lyrics. Plus, Fiona Mosley with her novel Elmet, a finalist for the Man Booker Prize. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. Welcome back to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and with me in the studio, making her Broadway debut in the play The Parisian Woman, the one, the only, Uma Thurman. Uma, again, thank you for being here.
I'm so happy to be here.
Have you spent any time in Washington?
Not really. I went for some inaugurations.
Past
inaugurations, yeah, some old ones.
I imagine. Bill Clinton in the 90s.
Yes.
Obama's
yes.
in the 2009.
That would be true. Yeah.
Do you, in doing this play and doing The Parisian Woman, and the fact that it is set in present day Washington and that it is so Washington. When you read the rewritten script, because as you said, this was started in 2011, a completely different world then. Did what you read in terms of the rewritten script strike you as like, this is completely, this can't possibly be true. This can't possibly be real.
You mean the reality part, the reality show that we're actually really watching,
right?
That is actually real. the real news. The real news is quite shocking. To me, it actually made the play even more necessary to do, because I think that to help process this kind of madness, it's something that the theater has been there to do for the throughout history. You know, it's theater is somewhat for pleasure and otherwise for social process. And I think that the experience of being on that stage, at some point, I won't say when, but there's only one point that the character does quote the current president, and I actually do get to say the words locker room talk, and the whole house usually goes down in in what is laughter, and you know, the sort of the source of comedy, which is pain. is what this, that we didn't even think this play would be as funny as people find it.
Well, see, I was going to ask you about that, because there were moments when people, the laughter in the audience was partly comedic, partly cathartic, partly laughing to keep from crying.
That's exactly right. You got it.
Were you surprised by that when you started hearing laughter from the audience?
I think all of us were surprised by how, I mean, maybe the director and the playwright were not surprised as we were as actors, but you know, it's None of the quote comedy is played as comedy. It's actually drama that is painfully funny, because it's pushing the buttons of what is our reality today.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are some really terrific lines in the play, and I just, as I was reading them to you during the break, I realized they're all from Jeanette.
Jeanette's a witty woman.
Blair Brown, played by Blair Brown, and she is the person who is nominated to be the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and
whom
Chloe invests a lot of time in terms of getting her help. And there's this wonderful line where she says, in a land of sinners, the whore is queen.
Well, that sums it up. I always actually, when she says that line, I simply turn and stare at the audience with very little expression.
And usually, when I went to see it the other night, there was this sort of, there was a gasp and then laughter, because it's like, oh, actually, that's, wow, that's a very creative, inventive line, and true.
I guess so. I guess so. You know, it's a slippery slope.
You know, you have a line, Chloe has a line, where I believe it's you and probably Peter, your lover, not your husband, where you're talking about things, and I can't remember what exactly you were talking about, but the person says, oh, you're being politically correct, and you say, not political correctness, it's correctness.
Yes.
What was that about?
Well, I guess the two men are sort of belittling the appointment of a woman, this woman, Blair Brown, as the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and he says, "Oh, but chairman though," and she says, "Chairwoman," and then he's like, "Oh, you're not going to be the politically correct, are you?" And then I say, naturally, she's a woman, Peter. It's not political correctness. It's just correctness. Mm-hmm. And you know, she's basically, you know, she's a feminist, Chloe. That's for damn sure.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's hard for people to speak up in real life, to speak up when someone feels offended, in the way that Chloe did, to speak up and for fear of being labeled so-called politically correct.
Well, that shift happened in our lifetime, I think, quite recently. I mean, not related to this administration, but, you know, when I was in high school and you know, the idea, I felt like political correctness became important and it was starting to infiltrate people's conversations and discussions. And then there's been this bizarre backlash against the idea of political correctness, like as if somehow fairness is somehow wrong.
Right, fairness.
I don't know how to put it.
Right, respect.
Respect is wrong. Fairness is wrong. You know, that, you know, there's the, that's what I've witnessed. It's the, you know, this somehow it's a put down to be standing up for mm-hmm. something. It's a way to attack a person.
Right, and usually the attack, I mean, everyone gets attacked with the politically correct label, but more often than not, it's women who get hit with that attack of being either politically correct or not being believed when they speak out about things by society.
Well, I mean, frankly, the treatment of women around the world, the condition of that as an international epidemic is appalling. So, you know, it's a big issue. I mean, different cultures, different ways of doing it, but the mistreatment and disrespect of women is an enormous international disease.
You know, I want to ask you about something, and I'm going to be very ginger about it. Because I know this is...
There's nothing ginger about asking something on live
radio.
Radio. So go ahead.
All right. You have been in fantastic films that were produced by Harvey Weinstein. We all know what happened. And on Instagram, you posted a message where you wrote, "I said I was angry recently and I have a few reasons. #MeToo. In case you couldn't tell by the look on my face, I feel it's important to take your time, be fair, be exact. So happy Thanksgiving, everyone." There was more. And then you said, "Stay tuned." In other interviews, you've said you'd speak out when the time was right. And given what you said about women and the treatment of women around the world, not just here.
Very much so.
Just wondering if the time is right.
The time is coming.
Is coming
very shortly
to say more
in short order. Yes, I think that, you know, this wave that's taking place of people being marched out of their offices and accusations flying and social justice happening on the sort of social level with a total absence of law enforcement being able somehow to handle it. It's a subject that's kind of very much on my mind, and I've been waiting to see if law enforcement would be able to address some of these things. And to me, that's a great concern that you know, that none of the sort of stuff that's going on is happening in a court of law, and the system being broken and other systems taking over is a concern. And so, yes, I have been very cautious and taken my time because, you know, I think that it's very important to measure how you talk about things and how it impacts people's lives, because if it goes wrongly, and I don't mean me, I'm not concerned about me, but in general, this movement, there will be a tremendous backlash. And, you know, a friend would say, don't talk about backlash, it gives backlash power. But, you know, it is something that growing up, born in 1970, I've seen a lot throughout my life. I've been working since I was 16 years old, so you can imagine.
Right.
And I think it's just very important to... I mean, I've been very focused on wondering, thinking about law enforcement and wondering how it is that a lot of this stuff just isn't going through them anymore. And, you know, but the time is certainly coming.
Mm-hmm. Are we capable as a society of learning the lessons? So I remember, I'm sure you remember, when the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings happened.
God.
And everybody was talking about this new thing, sexual harassment. Suddenly the nation had become awakened to this. And here
although
we are.
Did they?
Right.
Because here, what happened?
And here we are 25 years later talking about something that goes beyond sexual harassment. Are we capable of learning lessons?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's a deeply ingrained weirdness regarding this word called sex. Certainly in this country, founded by Puritans.
Well, yeah.
As a very intelligent person said to me, and it's going to sound really simplistic, but if I hit you over the head with a frying pan and take your wallet, say I'm a man, and I'm caught, I will go to jail, quite simply, for whatever length of time deemed necessary. But if I hit a woman over the head with a frying pan, and I have an erection, and she's wearing a short skirt, all of a sudden, the law enforcement wants to know what perfume she's wearing, and what did she say first before she got hit over the head, it's not about sex.
Yeah.
It's about violence and domination and abuse. And I think that that there's something very whack about this whole thing of the sort of compulsion of the powerless of the sexually aroused person to stop themselves from attacking someone else. It makes it the fault of the victim. And that's just a bunch of nonsense. I mean, to me, violence is violence. You transgress upon another person, you debase them, you demean them, and it shouldn't be treated so differently.
You grew up Buddhist, right?
I grew up with Buddhist parents.
With Buddhist parents.
Yes.
So you don't... So no, not you.
I was brought up with free will.
Uh-huh.
Both my parents, found Buddhism and converted to Buddhism in their own adult intelligent lives. And so they didn't particularly indoctrinate their children because they were coming away from their own indoctrination.
Mm-hmm. And so I asked that question because I was wondering how much of that might have played into your way of thinking about what you were just talking about this moment in time that we're in with Me Too and people coming forward who felt silenced or oppressed by the situations they were in.
Yeah. I mean, look, I put enormous effort into trying to think as 360 as I possibly can about things. And so much effort that my head nearly pops off. And perhaps it sort of has many times. But, I try to look at things from as many angles as possible and apply compassion to the situation and try to see things through different... one of the things about my job is to look through the eyes of another. And to try to stand in the shoes of another. I mean, that is, in fact, the number one technique, mm-hmm. I guess I could say, that certainly, I apply sort of imaginative empathy. You play for whatever you're doing. And it's something I'm thinking sort of deeply about. But, this sort of incarnate sexism that seems to be just born into us. And as a mother, I find it very, very deeply disturbing to, think of so many violent men who were somebody's son. And it's not something I am worried about as a mother, but as a mother, I find it deeply perplexing. Like women who largely do a lot of the work of raising children, is it that we just can the love we have for our sons not overcome the society? I don't know. Hmm. I don't know the answer to it.
What do you think Chloe would say, your character,
she
in The
Parisian
Woman?
She would choose not to have children.
No, well, that's true. She did decide not to have children. There's a big part there where she and Chloe and her husband are talking about that fact. So would you love to bring The Parisian Woman to Washington?
Well, you had mentioned this to me when you came backstage, and the idea of bringing it to Washington in some way that made sense, I think would be exhilarating. I think it would be very interesting. You're the first person that brought it up. There's discussion of bringing it to Europe. But
A play about Washington. Why not have it performed in Washington?
I think you're a genius, and I think it's a very good idea, and I've already learned all the lines. So,
what do you think, or how do you think a Washington audience would react to seeing a play that holds up a mirror to Washington?
I don't know. I imagine that some might laugh and others might pick up rocks. I don't know. Break that mirror.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
All right. So we got to figure out, because I would love to see The Parisian Woman in Washington performed before a Washington audience. With this administration in office, to see how Washington would react. I'm not sure how.
Well, there was a woman who had some close contact with somebody, I won't say who gave it a standing ovation.
Someone in the administration?
I won't say who.
Oh, come on.
No.
Uma, we're such friends.
Well,
come on.
Sometimes you have to keep other people's secrets when they discreetly come in and sit down and just want to watch a play.
Ah, very interesting. So, as I mentioned before, this is your Broadway debut.
Yes.
This is your second theatrical role on stage, on the theater stage. You want to do it again?
I find it exhausting and kind of addictive. The discipline of having first of all, I never leave the stage also, right?
So right, you're in every scene.
We're talking, this play runs 94 minutes long, and if it's a minute longer, I get scolded, without any intermission. And I'm in the beginning and end of every scene, and I quick change between each scene. So for me, it's a super athletic event, even though, you know, in theory, I'm not singing or dancing, but it's intense. But it's very exciting to be so fully taxed, so fully used. You know, it kind of takes it all out of me each time, and it requires every skill that I have. In a way, I mean, obviously, different parts require different things, but It's very exciting, you know, to deliver this play sometimes twice a day. It's like delivering two babies a day.
Oh, my God. And how is it different? This is like a leading question, but really, how is it different from film acting? Is it more taxing or taxing in a different way?
It's completely different. It's not different in that acting is acting. Certainly, there are things that, you have to do very specifically differently for film.
And, such as?
Film, depending on where the camera is and how wide the shot is, you know, it's all about condensing meaning and matter. And, you know, you don't project your voice on film unless you're playing a lawyer. You know what I mean? I mean, pretty more an opera singer, in the same way as you do on stage, and you know, unless it's a wide shot, you're not using your whole body in the same way. And in fact, sometimes you have to, you know, try to be incredibly still, you know, because film magnifies so much with the closer the camera gets. It's very technical. I don't know if our listeners probably will apply it in their own lives. Necessarily, although with the iPhone these days, possibly.
Right. Well, next time I'm on television on MSNBC, I'm going to see if I can try to not move from my neck down.
Well, when you watch television and you look at people who throw their hands around.
That's me.
You know, well, though, when you get serious, I bet you don't.
When I get I'm a table thumper.
You're a pounder.
I pound the table. my arms and hands are going. I mean, that's just, I don't know how to control it.
Well, maybe that's because your arms and hands are in frame. You see, in film, when they get up to your jaw or mm-hmm. under your lip and above your eyebrows, you don't want to be doing this because right. you'll be out of focus.
Well, you don't have to worry about that when you're on the stage, when you're on the Broadway stage, and when you are in the lead role of the play at the Hudson Theater on 44th Street called The Parisian Woman. I've been speaking with Uma Thurman about her Broadway debut in The Parisian Woman, which is playing again at the Hudson Theater. That's at 141 West 44th Street. Uma, it's great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been fun.
A lot of fun.
I was worried.
Really?